Literary Hyperlinks, the Post-War World, the Cold War. At the end of the Second World War, much of Europe was in ruins. An agreement had already been drawn up between the Allied powers, particularly the United States and USSR, to determine the eventual control of liberated territories. The countries of Eastern Europe, occupied by the Soviet Red Army, remained under Soviet communist influence, while Western Europe fell under the economic and political influence of the United States, who provided extensive financial aid for the rebuilding and modernization of their economies. The Marshall Plan. In Asia, meanwhile, the United States exerted almost complete control over a defeated Japan. Though both powers had tacitly agreed to stay out of each other's zone of influence, tension rose in 1949 when Russia acquired the nuclear bomb and China fell to communist revolution, though it was not subsequently allied with the Soviets. The world then fell under the menacing shadow of the Cold War, a 30-year period of arms building and the prospect of nuclear confrontation. The United States' determination to protect and consolidate its overseas economic and military interests against communist insurgency led to two major conflicts, first in Korea during the 1950s and then, more disastrously, Vietnam during the 1960s and 70s, a conflict that led to the emergence of an international anti-war movement. An easing of tension. The build-up of nuclear arms on both sides continued up to the 1970s, when it began to attenuate thanks to a series of limitation agreements. The two superpowers continued to maintain civil but uneasy relations until the coming to power in Russia of Mikhail Gorbachev and the advent of Glasnost, Russian for speaking aloud, a term describing the changes in attitude on the part of leaders of Soviet Union since 1985. And perestroika, the process of reconstructing Soviet society through a program of reforms initiated the same year, signaled more open, friendly relations and further reduction of nuclear arms. At this point, nobody in the West yet suspected how close the Soviet Union was to collapse. It was partly, thanks to Gorbachev's insightful reform program, that the democratic revolutions, which swept across Eastern Europe in 1989, from East Germany to Czechoslovakia and Romania, were achieved with such remarkably little bloodshed, but the ethnic wars which took place in countries of the former Yugoslavia during the 1990s showed how superficial the foundations of the new democracies were. Britain after the war, the Suez Crisis and the end of the British Empire. The coronation of Elizabeth II in 1953, broadcast on national television, attempting to conserve in the minds of the public the image of Britain as a great imperial power. But in reality, the years after the Second World War were to mark a period of rapid decolonization and the disintegration of the British Empire, beginning with India, which was partitioned into two independent nations, India and Pakistan in 1947, thanks to the efforts of figures such as the anti-colonialist leader Jawaharlal Nehru. The process was accelerated by the repercussions of the 1956 Suez Crisis, when Britain and France tried to re-establish imperial control over Egypt's newly nationalized Suez Canal by sending a combined military force to attack and occupy Egypt. President Nasser of Egypt, in buying arms from the Soviet bloc, had angered the United States, who subsequently withdrew funding for the building of the Ashan Dam. In order to raise the necessary funds, Nasser decided to nationalize the canal. The invasion, however, was a fiasco and was openly condemned by the countries of the Commonwealth and by Eisenhower himself in the United States. As a result, strong anti-British feeling arose in the colonies, which began to resent their imperial masters and asserted their right to independence. Britain was thus forced to relinquish imperial control in these countries more quickly than had been originally planned. During the 1960s, A large number of colonies won their independence, including Nigeria in 1960 and Jamaica in 1962, though Rhodesia held out until 1980, when it became the Republic of Zimbabwe. However, the newly elected governments of ex-colonies had more problems to face. With their own modernization programs, strangled by debt, they became economically dependent on the United States, whose policies would leave these countries weakened and open to a new form of colonization by multinational businesses. Moreover, in the areas where the map had been redrawn after the war, such as in India and Pakistan, there was continued conflict fueled by religious antagonism. War between India and Pakistan in 1965 was followed by another dispute in 1971, when, with India's encouragement, part of East Pakistan broke away to form the independent state of Bangladesh. Another problem faced by ex-colonies was that they were rarely democratic in the parliamentary sense, but oscillated between single-party and military rule. Even in a relatively successful country like India, state corruption and repression were common. An example was the 1975 state of emergency, declared by India's then leader Indira Gandhi, who was later assassinated. Towards a multicultural society, whether as a result of political instability or economic hardship, successive waves of immigrants came to Britain in search of better prospects, particularly following the 1948 Act of Parliament giving automatic British citizenship to all Commonwealth members. Racial discrimination and segregation, endorsed by the native British population, provoked resentments, which eventually boiled over in the 1981 riots in Brixton, London, an area with an Afro-Caribbean minority of roughly 25%, and where unemployment stood at 50%, it was the center of Operation Swamp, in which a massively expanded police force stopped and searched almost 1,000 black men without evidence of any crime. Following the riots, a public inquiry was held and resulted in a report that emphasized that policing in a civil society can succeed only with the consent of the community. Slowly, with the passing of the generations, the new residents of the United Kingdom, initially from the Caribbean and later from India and Pakistan, have begun to win acceptance and have helped to build the foundations of a more multicultural society. Particularly in the last few decades, hybrid racial and cultural identities began to emerge among the children of first-generation immigrants, creating the conditions for more stable, multi-ethnic integration and leading to a wave of dynamic cross-pollination in music, the arts, sport, food, architecture and literature. The reform of capitalism and the welfare state. After the Second World War, Western governments realized that in order to prevent future wars, the laissez-faire system of free market capitalism would have to be reformed. Since it was in part the mass unemployment and social unrest resulting from the Great Depression of the 1930s that had generated and strengthened the Nazi menace, any future system of government needed to have full employment as one of its primary objectives. Successive post-war British governments, beginning with the Labour government of Clement Attlee and continuing with the Conservatives, Winston Churchill, Anthony Eden, Harold Macmillan and Alec Douglas Home, implemented a system of centralized social and economic planning. Vital major industries, such as coal, steel and car manufacture, were nationalized and subsidized by the state. 20% of British industry was nationalized during the Attlee years alone. The welfare state and the emergency of a mass consumer's economy. These years saw the development of a welfare state that would sustain the unemployed and socially disadvantaged by providing public housing and efficient public services, such as health, education and transport. As industrial trade unions grew in strength, wages rose steadily, and the general standard of living began to rise, creating the conditions for the emergence of a mass consumer economy. For the first time, working-class people began to have access to the kind of goods and services, cars, domestic comforts, holiday abroad, that had previously been only available to a small wealthy minority. Moreover, thanks to the expansion of higher education and the availability of education grants, they were able to send their children to university, allowing them to move up the class ladder. The consumer boom was also possible thanks to advances in production technology and materials which made goods cheaper and more easily available than ever before. The decline of the wealth estate and the rise of Thatcherism. By the late 1960s, the general trend in Western countries was towards economic decline due to lack of domestic investment and a high rate of inflation. By the 1970s, the situation was becoming critical, mainly thanks to the worldwide recession which followed the oil crisis of 1973, and there were numerous strikes organized by industrial trade unions in support of bigger pay rises. In a global economy which tended increasingly towards free market liberalism, the dream of the wealth estate was proving too costly to maintain. The long recession which followed the oil crisis of 1973 was to mark the beginning of the decline of the wealth estate. In 1979, Margaret Thatcher, the leader of the Conservative Party, was elected Prime Minister of Britain. Thatcher's determination in pursuing her political programs earned her the nickname the Iron Lady. Her policies were based on the philosophy of individualism. One of her mottos was, "There is no such thing as society." The free market and the privatization of Britain's nationalized enterprises in order to make industry more competitive and to lower prices. Among the first companies to be privatized were British Telecom, British Gas, British Airways, and Cable and Wireless. Welfare services such as social assistance to the poor, unemployment benefit, and the health service were damaged by state underfunding, as the Conservative Party encouraged private management and financing of these services. Under the Thatcher government, mass unemployment returned as nationalized industries were sold off, broken up or closed down, although a lot of people also became rich through a stock market boom, the so-called Big Bang of 1986, the establishment in the City of London of a sophisticated computer network enabled rapid trading on the international debt markets. The 1980s became known as the Decade of Greed. Images of wealth, power and excess were popularized by the increasingly influential fashion and advertising industries, and by films such as Oliver Stone's Wall Street, with its ambiguous villain, Gondo Jekyll, and his motto, "Greed is good." On the international front, in 1982, in the midst of a major recession at home, the government sent English troops to rescue the Falkland Islands off the coast of Argentina from occupation by Argentina, who had laid claim to sovereignty over them. With the support of the right-wing tabloid press, the Falklands War helped Thatcher to consolidate her popularity and gain a second term in office, arousing nationalistic feeling and nostalgia for the days of the British Empire. During its second term, one of the hardest battles fought by the Thatcher government regarded the closure of Britain's coal mines. The fight against the National Union of Miners, who vigorously protested against the proposed closure of pits and consequent large-scale unemployment, was eventually won, again with the assistance of the popular press. The last years of the Thatcher government. Thatcher's government returned for a third term in office and in 1987 introduced the highly unpopular poll tax. This local government tax replaced the unwieldy rating system, which was based on the size of your house and your ability to pay for a flat fee, regardless of income, for every member of the household who was on the electoral register. There were riots in the capital in 1990. Partly due to strong opposition and growing unrest among her own party, Margaret Thatcher resigned from office later that year. Other more moderate conservatives took over, and they enjoyed a fourth term in office under John Major, who, after repealing the new poll tax measures, continued the process of dismantling the social structures that had been built up in the 30 years after the war. The rise of New Labour. Tony Blair's modernized Labour government took office in 1997 winning a massive majority in Parliament. It was the first Labour government in Britain since 1979. However, the so-called New Labour was no longer committed to the nationalisation of industries and its old socialist principles of full employment and state-funded services. Under the leadership of Blair, the privatisation that had begun under the Thatcher government continued, and Labour's political orientation, both in domestic and foreign policy, shifted increasingly towards the right. In 2007, after a decade in power, Tony Blair resigned as Prime Minister, and Treasury Chief Gordon Brown succeeded him, but had immediately to face the waning popularity of the Labour government in the light of policies such as privatisation, cuts in public services, and British involvement in the Second Gulf War. Brown had been, along with Blair, one of the principal architects of the New Labour project, although it was generally believed that the former and his allies within the Labour Party were more committed to social equality and the redistribution of income than the Blairites. After an initial surge in popularities, Brown's political fortunes fell as a result of his perceived political indecisiveness and political manoeuvring by a revived Conservative opposition under David Cameron. Brown's reputation also rested on his management of the economy under Blair. In the wake of the crisis in the United States housing market and the ensuing near collapse of the global financial system in 2008, the prevailing view, shared by Labour and Conservatives alike, that free market capitalism would ensure prosperity, was subject to renewed critical appraisal. However, Brown was subsequently able to partially revive his political fortunes through the advocacy of direct government investment in the banking system and Keynesian economic policies. The Irish question. As we have seen, in the early 20th century, Ireland was divided into two parts, the Irish Free State, which remained, however, a dominion of the British Empire, and Ulster, which stayed within the United Kingdom. In 1948, the Irish Free State became the Republic of Ireland, gaining complete independence from the British Empire. Following the Second World War, the creation of the welfare state privileged the Protestants, granting them higher living standards and giving them more power. In 1968, the Catholics organized a civil rights movement. However, in 1969, after an escalation of tension, there were violent riots between the Protestant and the Catholic communities in Londonderry and Belfast. The British government sent troops to ensure peace, but the situation deteriorated dramatically after the infamous events of Bloody Sunday, when several Catholic demonstrators were shot dead by the army. The relations between the army and the Catholic population became increasingly tense, and violence on both sides continued. The IRA, Irish Republican Army, began a bombing campaign which extended to the British mainland, resulting in Irish nationalists being labelled as terrorist sympathisers, and to the wrongful conviction and imprisonment of a number of Irish men and women, most notably the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six, for bombing they did not commit. In 1994, Sinn Féin, the political party closest to the IRA, announced a ceasefire. However, this did not stop violence and terrorist attacks by both the IRA and Protestant terrorist groups. Even today, relations between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland are extremely uneasy. Non-violent independence movements have grown, meanwhile, in Wales, which maintains its own language, and Scotland, where a self-governing parliament was recently established. Social and cultural transformation in post-war Europe. Perhaps the most significant social transformation of the post-war period in Britain and elsewhere in Europe was the emergence of women as a major force in the workplace. A decline of the traditional sources of male employment in the manufacturing industry was accompanied by expansion of administration, service, and consumer industries, which provided jobs to which women were often better socially adapted than men. Another important change, and a direct result of a new consumer-driven economy, was the emergence of a specific youth-led popular culture, based on fashion and rock and pop music, initially imported from the US, which created a widening generation gap between old and young. The consumer boom reached its peak in the 1960s and was also a second golden age for experimentation, both in the arts and in terms of people's lifestyles. Sexual taboos were lifted, and the more adventurous and affluent youth embraced the values of the new permissive society. Accompanying this new wave of hedonism, however, was a growing critical awareness, particularly among the now much expanding student and university population, that consumer society masked persistent social divisions and was made possible by hidden mechanism of economic exploitation, particularly in third world countries. Opposition to the Vietnam War helped to galvanize this protest movement, which reached its peak in the worldwide student uprisings of 1968, from Paris to Prague to Tokyo to Mexico City. Though in Britain this movement was far less prominent than in other countries, it marked a profound dissatisfaction among young people with their society. The feminist movement in particular grew significantly in the wake of 1968. Society's response, however, was to try to sell young people's dissatisfaction back to them in the form of consumerism. During the 1970s, and most markedly in the 1980s, a society which had been based largely on the planned interaction of social groups and classes, with their particular interests and privileges to defend, became replaced by a more individualized one, in which communities were fragmented, systems of social protection dismantled. People were freed or forced to compete with each other in an open market, to look after their own interests, and to pursue their own consumer desires.